Back on the air, and I'm here, of course, with my good friend and co-host Grant Rubin on stage.
Hey, Grant. Back and better than ever, Doug. It's great to be back. We had a short hiatus here, but I'm excited about some of the new shows that are coming up. I'm especially excited about our guest tonight.
Yes, we have Bill Burns with us tonight. We're going to talk about ancient aliens and related stuff, and just a couple of things to go over before we get into that discussion. We have a new call screener, Jamie Havikin, is with us. Of course, he's the producer of Inception Radio. He's got his own network as well, so he's with us, and we appreciate that. He's also acting as executive producer for us and lining up guests, and so we're happy to have him.
Absolutely.
If you'd like to call in tonight to ask our guest a question, you can do that. The numbers are on your screen, 347-945-7799, or you can use that click the talk button, the Skype button, if you've got that. Same venue as always, just a new night, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., and hopefully we can attract more people, being at a little bit of an earlier hour, at least on the East Coast. We also want to give our very best to our Paranexus member, Joan Del Rio, who has just had some surgery and doing well, so we hope that she recovers very soon.
And, wishing her a speedy recovery.
Lots of positive energy in her direction, as well as Rick and Lori. So, that having been said, tonight we have with us Bill Burns, first appearance on Paranexus Universe. Of course, you're probably very familiar with Bill from the TV show UFO Hunters, Ancient Aliens. I've been watching him on documentaries since I was wee little. Okay, that's a total lie. I'm too old for that.
Yeah, we know better.
Bill, great to have you on the program. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here, and thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a pleasure. We admire your work, and we're excited to be able to talk to you. So, welcome.
You know, I think, Bill, the first time I saw you on a documentary was, I can't remember what it was. Was it UFO Files? I can't remember. But you were talking about USOs. Remember that one?
Right. That was actually one of the later UFO Files that we did. But I was on UFO Files all the way back as early as 2003, 2004 on some of the first ones we did.
Yeah, I probably saw you on those too. That was the one that kind of registered, and of course I've seen you on Ancient Aliens, watched all the UFO Hunters, and let's talk about UFO Hunters and the alien or ancient astronauts connection, the TV show, real quick to kind of get everybody what.
Sure. Well, Ancient Aliens, which is now going into its third season. So congratulations to everybody who's involved with that show. Prometheus Productions, they were just green-lighted for season three, so which is great, and they're going to start shooting. In fact, I've got to make plans to get on location with them. They're going to start shooting as early as probably late this month, early next month for that. So good. I'm not sure when the first episode is going to air, but it's going to air probably sometime in this. They're going to start running episodes on history in the spring.
Good.
So we're all gearing up for an intense schedule. And they're exploring some new territory in Ancient Aliens, obviously looking at the same kinds of legends of UFOs in ancient times, looking to see whether there's any evidence, whether the stories about starships from the sky, star people, are have any basis in fact. And so we're looking at a number of things. Ancient Aliens, actually the idea for Ancient Aliens was first pitched to the network, believe it or not, by Pat Usker on UFO Hunters.
Really?
And Pat and I pitched this all the way back in season one, and it took two more seasons for the network to pick up on the concept. And the seed of Ancient Aliens first appeared in the first episode of season three, episode 301, on it was in which we were talking about giant triangles. And we invited Giorgio Tsoukalos as our guest, and he showed us that ancient bird piece
mm-hmm.
of jewelry he was carrying that looked remarkably like the space shuttle.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And so our science in the show was to have our modeler, our science projects producer, Brick Price, up in the valley in San Fernando Valley in California, make a replica, a scale replica mm-hmm. of that bird to see if that thing could glide. Obviously, without a propulsion system, it wasn't going to fly, but could it glide? And if so, could it glide? And I think that was one of the great moments on the show was we took Giorgio's piece of jewelry, literally blew it up in a balsa wood model, weighted the nose, and launched it from a little catapult, the way you'd launch a model flying plane. And sure enough, the thing had lift, it floated, it glided, and then nose up, settled down to a tail first landing like the space shuttle. And from that segment, the network was so thrilled that we had Giorgio back for later episodes in mm-hmm. which we compared the engravings, the markings on rocks north of Phoenix in Tucson, Arizona, to various videos of UFOs that local residents had taken. And that was very exciting. And the next thing we knew, Ancient Aliens was a special, and then it became a series, and now it's in season three.
Well, there were two or at least two episodes that were 2 hours long each, right?
Right.
And then they went to the one-hour format?
That's right. The first season, there were 5 2-hour episodes.
Oh, really? Five? And I'm missing some.
The second season, there were 10 1-hour episodes, and I think we're going to have 10 1-hour episodes again this season.
Hmm. That's interesting, because I had thought I'd gotten all of those, but I don't recall seeing five.
Well, you know, I remember that episode so very well, where you were with the, mm-hmm. with the piece of jewelry that you guys duplicated. And, you know, you didn't have to be an aeronautical engineer to see that that thing was aerodynamic. And, you know, it was just it was remarkable when they, just reassembled it and got it to fly like that. And that was really an eye-opener for me. It really made me think, and especially when you guys brought out the fact about the catapult, because I had never thought about that.
Right. I mean, I mean, think about it from these two things. Those who say, well, it's really a bird, but birds' wings aren't that far back on the body uh-huh. of the bird. That's uh-huh. one, right? And birds don't have a tail assembly the way that object had a tail assembly.
Right.
So those are two issues. And then if it doesn't have a propeller, and it doesn't have a jet engine, and of course the space shuttle glides home, it doesn't really fly home under power. If it doesn't have a propeller or a jet engine, what's the basis of the lift? Well, the basis of the lift is you push the thing off a cliff and see if it flies.
Uh-huh.
And if ancient peoples, the Maya or the Inca or the Aztecs, if they saw a craft, and yeah, I believe it's a time capsule, but if they saw a craft gliding to a dead stick landing and they modeled that craft, that's basically from their own pantheon of divine beings, if they believed that was their craft, and they built something like that in imitation of it. And like seagulls, like condors, like large winged birds, they believed it could actually glide, and you push an unmanned version of it off a cliff and watch it glide on the air currents. Wouldn't it be incredible if they themselves flew using those gliders? And I think that might have been that experience based on something they saw. It's a cargo cult thing. You know, they saw this thing. They built a model of it.
Yep. And it, you know, they, and when you think about the catapult, you know, that would be the easiest way for them, because I think I give human beings a great deal of credit. I think that's what you're saying, too. You know, they see it. We want to build it. We imitate it, the highest form of flattery to the gods. And then, you know, but to launch it by a catapult, that's ingenious. But, you know, the whole idea of being able to see it and translate that, that's what I find really remarkable, you know. And I think the other thing, too, that I find really interesting is the similarities, as I think the series points out, between what went on in, you know, Egypt, what happened in Central America and other parts of the, on the globe, where you see consistency. And I think that's really great that you guys do that, that effort to show that that you can connect the dots.
Yeah. That was a pivotal episode. I mean, that was great, a great episode. Hey, refresh my memory, Bill. Where was that figure, that model, originally found?
I'm not sure of the country, but it was in Central America.
Okay. So, and I know Giorgio uses that as a lapel pin, and I mean, that's a cool. I mean, it's, to me, it's one of those things that, oh my God, you know, it's compelling for the ancient alien type of thing. And let's get into that a little bit. You know, some of us have seen the Ancient Alien series, okay, fair enough, but let's talk a little bit about that. What kind of compelling evidence do we have that aliens might have been involved in human development over
the
eons?
I think by aliens, what we're calling aliens are anomalous, are life forms, even if they're human, life forms anomalous to the culture where they are, that they are seeding. So for example, you look at these phenomena that shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I'm not even going to go into the carving of stones, because any debunker or skeptic can argue anybody can carve a stone. Sure, the edges fit too perfectly. Sure, the stones are too big to be carried up the sides of mountains. Why are they in the shape they're in? You know what? Since that's open to argument, we can leave it alone. Although I believe that shows the presence of some otherworldly entity in those cultures, we could leave it alone. For me, it is, why are there glyphs, hieroglyphs or ideographs or pictographs of images that look like helicopters, look like aircraft? Why are those inscribed in ruins, on pyramids, on temples? Why are they there? How did something from the 20th century get 1,000 years in the past, or in the case of Egypt, 7,000 or 8,000 years in the past? How did it get there? Why are there images, and this is the point of the late Zechariah Sitchin, why are there images of what look like creatures in spacesuits, things coming out of their heads, in the Sumerian cuneiforms in ancient Babylonia? Why are they there? Well, these people, these artisans who carved these cuneiforms, who drew these pictographs, didn't invent this stuff out of nothing. Ancient cultures depicted what they saw. So for somebody to depict a helicopter, a stylized helicopter, on a ruin of a temple, saw that image, what did that person see? That, to me, is, I think, the most compelling evidence for the presence of something otherworldly in a culture where it doesn't belong.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know the thing about it is I think most people lose sight of this, is the fact that, I mean, if you look at us cosmologically, we're like on the edge of the frontier out here of our galaxy. And, you know, it may take a spacefaring culture a long time to get out here. And if they did get out here, you know, whatever they build, it could have been a long, long time ago what they put up here. And one of the things I thought that was really interesting, you guys pointed out as well, was in, you know, some of those South American countries where those block buildings are so tightly carved and so neatly placed together, and there's no doubt, there's no refuting that nobody had those capabilities to etch the stone or carve the stone the way that they did. But, you know, it's always made me wonder about whether or not a more sophisticated culture came here. And if you look at the Earth from the orbit, what looks like one of the most beautiful places in the world to live would probably be down in the Nile Valley. It probably stands out like a jewel above there. So they, you know, if they were halfway sophisticated, started, you know, coming down in shuttles or whatever, and had helicopters, whatever, you know, it just boggles the mind that these folks saw it and they recorded it.
And now this wonderful argument that was made by Seth Osnack of SETI, right, the director of SETI, he and Dan Friedman have this ongoing debate. Seth Shostak, as he said to us on the phone, he's made very clear. He said that it just makes no sense for an alien culture to travel 8 million light years just to come to planet Earth for what? A drink of water, a pit stop. And of course, Dan Friedman said,
Hey Bill, let me interrupt you there for a second. I don't know if Grant, is he coming over?
Yeah, he's coming over. He's kind of breaking up.
Breaking up. Let's give it just 1 second, Bill, and see if it corrects. Because a lot of that was garbled. Couldn't quite make it out. Hey, Bill, I'm going to call you right back. Apparently just a poor Skype line, so I'm going to call you right back. We'll get Bill back on the line here, maybe get a bit of a better connection.
Yeah, that was not a good connection.
No, we'll have him repeat that.
Yeah, because I want to hear what you had to say.
Yeah, that was very interesting. And you back with us, Bill?
I am back.
Okay.
That's much better. We're sorry about that. And we wanted everybody to hear what your response to what I had said.
So, yeah, would you go back and repeat that, Bill? And we'll.
Well, what I'm saying is that there is this debate. I don't know if it was a personal debate or a debate over long distance that between Seth Shostak, who's the director of SETI, and Seth argued that why would an extraterrestrial culture that he believes is out there, otherwise we wouldn't be doing SETI, why would they come millions and millions of light years to planet Earth for a drink of water, for a pit stop, for, you know, a piece of broccoli? I mean, what's the point? I mean, they're coming this far. And Stan Friedman made the point, why do you presuppose automatically that whenever we see a flying saucer overhead, when somebody spots some strange lights, that it's somebody coming from a gazillion light years away for a glass of water?
Uh-huh.
I mean, what if they've been here? What if they've been here for thousands of years? What if what you're seeing are craft that are, what, parked on the other side of the moon, parked near Jupiter? That literally, if they can move close to the speed of light, believe me, they're here. They don't have to surpass the speed of light. They don't have to be using warp drive. I mean, maybe they are. But the point is, they don't have to have a technology millions of years ahead of ours. And they don't have to come from, a million light years away just to get here. They could already be here.
What he failed to point out, and then when Stan was on our show, you know, we talked about this, was most people don't understand that there's stars that are like within 40 light years of Earth, and there's quite a few of them, or maybe 40 or so, I think. And people lose sight of that, and they forget that, you know. They think that everything is just like, you know, 200 light years away.
That's right, and we are in... And as more and more exoplanets in the habitable zone around their own stars are picked up by the Hubble telescope and other telescopes, that we're discovering there are Earth-like planets. And I'm not even going to go into we anthropomorphize alien life. It's got to look.
Absolutely.
But let's just say for argument that's – let's stick in that narrow band, then really, quite frankly, we're discovering more and more planets. And you know what? It only takes one to have an alien species, and the alien species could look very much like us and might only be a few hundred years ahead of us. So we're talking about we're living in the 21st century. They're in their 23rd century, and they're moving around in warp drive spaceships. So it doesn't mean they're millions of years ahead of us, or even thousands of years ahead of us.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing that I think that's interesting here too, Bill, and I think, you know, it's just not spoken of enough, is you know, parallel evolution. Okay, you know, like there was a guy who was doing some research on some of the photographs that were taken on Mars. You know how they claim that there was fossils there. Now I'm not sure. Some of them were very interesting looking. They look like ancient crinoids. But you know, the bottom line is who's to say there's not parallel evolution when the conditions are right, so that you know you're going to naturally. I think Mother Nature is going to go with what works best. You know, it's going to experiment, no doubt about it, because it has. We all know that. But I think if the conditions are right, it's going to go with a successful pattern.
Of course it is. I mean, and I mean, it was, again, Seth Shostak who made the point to us that we're really Martians. Because all the way back years and years ago, the Martian rocks discovered in Arctic ice contained the remnants of the breakdown of proteins that could only have been made by biological processes on that planet. It was those rocks that seeded our oceans. So it could well be that before there was life on Earth, there were life forms on Mars, whether it's just bacterial life, maybe it was more advanced forms of life that seeded life on planet Earth. So in some cases, the parallel development might have been parallel development that was separated by a huge timeline. And we could literally be the descendants of a Martian culture. Mars became a dead planet. Earth was very hospitable.
Absolutely possible.
Well, you know, I mean, if you look at historical geology, I mean, you know, people, I mean, who's to say that the timelines, that's all our perception. I mean, you know, say that, you know, the Precambrian was 500 million years ago. Well, how do we know it wasn't 500,000 million years ago? I mean, I'm not so sure that, you know, that radiocarbon dating is all that accurate. You know, I think there's probably better methods. But, I mean, sure, you got to have a starting point. But, you know, I just have this inclination to think that the Earth is a lot older than most people give it credit for.
Well, even if it is or even if it isn't, the point is that science – I just keep getting back to the fact that science tends to have a very closed-minded view of the universe. That, I mean, the scientific method, the scientific process, the process by which people earn advanced degrees and doctorates, believe me, I'm not going to criticize it that much because that's the process that I went through, is a process. I mean, Dr. Jack Sarfati and I talked about this on Saturday on our show Future Theater on this network. Basically, that the whole process of getting an advanced degree, a doctorate in your chosen field, is finding a niche in which you can travel that niche and make a very small point, and then earn your little spot on the cliff of PhDs in your particular field. And you are warned very early in, don't make these huge, grandiose, earth-shaking statements. All you're doing is getting a degree. You're not changing the world. Well, unfortunately, that kind of thinking permeates much of modern scholarship, and people don't make these grandiose thoughts. They stay in their little niche fields. So as a result, excuse me, and I'm just going to lower the volume on this. So as a result, what happens is people tend to be very narrow in their in their approach to this. So my point is that you're not going to get scientists who are going to jeopardize their careers, their academic careers, their government grant-getting careers. You're not going to get that. What you're going to get are people who are going to be playing it very close to the vest. So that's why you don't see scientists deviating that much from the norm.
We have a couple of questions in the chat room I'd like to cover, too. And by the way, I'm with you 1,000% on the mainstream science thing. The first question is, are the crystal skulls related to ancient aliens?
Well, there are number of arguments. I mean, some say they're independent of ancient aliens, and others say no, that they were made kind of like the bird mock-ups or the space shuttle mock-ups in emulation of alien creatures that were here, that they're
you're popular
that they're
guy.
Some that they're totemic, okay?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And that they have certain, I don't know if they have certain powers like Indiana Jones, but that they were made in ways that the ancient peoples could not have made them.
Right.
They didn't have the tools to make crystal skulls like that. They're one piece. We don't even have the machines to do that now. So how did they do that then? Were they made themselves by the aliens?
Well, would it obviously imply a higher level of technology than they're credited for?
Well, right. I mean, they could have been given as kind of talismanic objects to the ancient cultures.
Sure.
That's interesting. All right. Well, here's another question. Kathy's wondering if different alien cultures may have inbred with humans. Hold on a sec. With human cultures, which in turn created the different cultures we have today. For example, Chinese, African, Mexican. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, there are entire lines of scholarship that are really based on the possibility that aliens have hybridized human culture. I mean, that's one of the stories, that there are aliens and humans that have intermingled,
mm-hmm.
and the DNA has been intermingled, and there are different kinds of cultures, and the different kinds of hybridization might well account for the various races. I think that there is sufficient scholarship to establish the rationale for various genetic groups. So I don't think that's really the case.
Hmm. All right, so let's talk about the archaeological record. Does it show any evidence of alien involvement way back when?
Well, the archaeological record is questionable to say the least. On the one hand, you have these giant structures, megaliths, that exist in places around the earth, which, as you said earlier, really were the construction of which were beyond the capability of people at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, somebody might argue, an ancient archaeologist, specializing in those structures, might say, no. I mean, you know, you're making a false argument. The fact that they exist dated at that period means that whoever built them, and unless you show me that an ancient alien built it, that those people were capable of that level of construction. So there's your basic argument, okay? We say, well, they didn't have the tools. They couldn't have made things that precisely. They couldn't have made things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then somebody's going to say, but they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you could show me the flying saucer that brought them there, or unless you could show me the physical evidence that some alien creature help that society move these huge stones into a circle around Stonehenge, you're going to have to go with the fact that the stones themselves speak for themselves and for the culture that they put them there. So there's your basic argument.
Uh-huh.
All right. I understand what they're saying. But, you know, you look at the pyramids, you look at Machu Picchu, you look at Stonehenge, you look at other structures near Cuzco, and the pyramids around the earth, you know, it is beyond me how they could have pulled those things off, especially with the precision that they did. I mean, maybe they did, but it's a compelling argument. We have a caller that has a question for you. Bill Teeger, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
You have a question for Bill?
Yeah. Bill, it's about your UFO show, the Hunter show you had. I had read that the reason that you guys got canceled or whatever is because of that Dulce show with the cattle mutilations and that questionable hybrid little baby or whatever it was. And I was just wondering if that was true.
I think that was one of the factors. I think that the network was furious that we pushed to air that we inserted that in the final cut, that they didn't let us dwell on it too much, but it created a stir. I mean, one thing that I can tell you is that after the show aired, we were told by Nancy Talbot of BLT Research that, and she is a very important scholar in the field of crop circle research other kinds of physical trace evidence research for UFOs. She made it very clear that we may be jumping up and down screaming aliens or hybridizing the species. Why they'd be hybridizing cows is not the issue. She said, look, what you really stepped into there is some kind of testing of creating entities, even if they never even come to term, still in the embryonic stage, to develop stem cells for certain kinds of other creatures. You're looking at stem cell research, and you're also looking at the testing of
xenotransplantation and things like that, right?
You're testing that, but you're also looking at mad cow disease and how it spreads in human beings. And she said, if in fact you have widespread mad cow disease, because what's been going on for decades in feeding the remains of cows, it's really cannibalistic, and it's not going to spread through humanity for another 20 years, then you're into some heavy-duty, big pharmaceutical research, and you're lucky they only slapped your hand. Because you're really stepping on some mighty, mighty big toes. So that was her take on it as well. She said, remember, bovine serum is what humans' egg cells, ovum, are cultured in for in vitro fertilization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the blood between bovine and human is not that far apart, and they use some of the bovine blood or use bovine plasma.
Yeah, bovine plasma. Now the other thing is that right after the show aired, Senators Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, I forget who else, Grassley, offered a bill in the Senate to amend Title 18, which is the federal criminal code, to make it a crime to interbreed humans and animals. So if there's a correlation between our airing that show and revealing that there was interbreeding going on between humans and bovines, and then senators stand up and make that a crime, you know that you've opened up a Pandora's box.
Yeah, you rattled somebody's cage on that. And
sure
I remember
did.
The time that when you guys did that show, I was stunned.
Mm-hmm.
I was absolutely stunned at that. And it was really at the end of the show where you really disclosed that. And it was just like, wow, you know. First thing I wanted to see the photographs. But nonetheless, that's just absolutely flipping scary. When you think about that kind of stuff,
it's very scary. I mean, there's no argument there. And if you look at Mystery Quest and you look at Ancient Aliens, one of the things you see, and I'm not knocking these shows, I'm saying, listen, Monster Quest, Mystery Quest, Ancient Aliens, for the network to say we're out of the UFO business is baloney. Because quite frankly, what you're seeing is UFO Hunters light, okay? They went back to the original UFOs format for some of these shows. I mean, Monster Quest made a mockery out of the Flatwoods Monster, which we covered in UFO Hunters. It's on the website. And made a mockery out of the Lloyd Pice Starchild skull, as if somehow they were told, look, at what you did for UFO Hunters. You better mend your wicked ways and shoot some holes in some of these
theories. Well, I think they're still serving their masters well, you know. And the bottom line is that, you know, they, you know, they make stuff still on the fringe of laughable, the way the media has always treated it, you know, so that if it gets too touchy or too scary or too factual, where people really might start scratching their heads and thinking about stuff, it's time to back off and let's go slap somebody's back or, you know, with tongue in cheek, we're going to talk about UFOs, you know.
Right. I mean, it's no mystery to me why after UFO Hunters was kind of off the air, ABC did another one of these phenomenal specials in which they're making fun of the whole UFO community. And the fact is, I would love to see, in fact, that's what we're, that's, you know, I mean, I'm still in the business and that's what we want to do, is literally show some of the undisputable facts about what we think show the existence of UFOs, that there is physical trace evidence, that there are steps that debunkers and skeptics have taken that are more distortions of the truth than they're saying UFOs are in terms of distortions of the truth. I mean, it's just ludicrous.
Well, after all these years, Bill, and I've followed this and Doug has for many, many years, you know, I've come to the conclusion it's one of two things. It's either that they do know what's going on, and they have known what's going on for a long time, or they don't have a clue what's going on. And they're running scared just like everybody else. And so it's just really hard after all these years. I mean, to me, I think that they're covering something up.
Well, look, when you see the extent to which they have turned inside out to create totally implausible explanations for things, I mean, I keep going back to – I mean, and we all have our pet cases, okay? I mean, mine is the 1952 UFO flap over Washington.
Oh, not landmark case.
Right, not just because of the presence of UFOs, not just because, and you know, great work done by Frank Ficino in his book Shoot 'Em Down.
Stan
Friedman, Alfred Lemberg. I mean, they've all done great scholarship here. My point is that stands by itself. To me, you go back to that time, and you look at what Edward Ruppelt wrote, who was the head of Blue Book, what Edward Ruppelt wrote about the 1952 UFO flap, and what you find is he's saying in his book, it's real, that the government forced, General Samet of the Air Force, forced the pilots and radar operators, air traffic controllers, to recant what they claimed originally and say these were all aberrations on their radar screen, which they were not.
Yeah.
So obviously either Samet on his own, which I doubt, or under pressure from Harry Truman, then president, who didn't want this hot potato in his lap and wanted to give it to Eisenhower and say, here, it's 1953, you're the new president, you handle this, I don't want to handle it.
Well, you know, the thing that I think is so remarkable about that case is, you know, when people say to you, and I know, Bill, this is going to resonate with you and Doug as well, when people go, well, if there are really UFOs out there and there's aliens, why don't they land on the White House lawn? Well, you know, in 1952, they hovered over the White House in Washington, D.C. for quite a while. And people completely lose sight of that, or it's just been they did such a good job of covering it up and smothering that story. Even though a lot of people witnessed it, it was in the newspapers and everything else, it just got eventually buried.
That's right. That's exactly what happened. There's no question about it. Why don't UFOs make themselves known? They did.
Absolutely.
They did it. We all saw it in 1952. The newspapers carried it. It was in the Movie Tone News. Then some general said it never happened. Do you believe me or your own lying eyes? We believed him, and that was the end of that.
All right, so here's a follow-up on a question in the chat room on the ancient alien technology versus maybe just advanced human technology. So the question is, could it be that we had more advanced technology back then and just lost it, lost record of it? Could it have been human technology?
Well, we certainly can ascertain from the Vedic texts about the Vimana that somehow there was very advanced flying technology and weaponry technology that the ancient Hindus had. And that technology, they wrote about that in the Vedic text. They were explicit. They described battles between flying saucers, battles between flying craft, all kinds of strange devices. And they even tell you how these craft were powered. Red mercury, encounter rotating cylinders, generating a huge radiation field and an anti-gravity field. So, I mean, it's explicit. Somehow the ancient Hindus were writing about that technology. We don't have that technology today, or do we? Is that what the Germans developed in the 1940s when they were creating this wonder weapon, the Wunderwaffe, called the Bell or Die Glocke, that in the final weeks of World War II would have won the war?
So do you think that the Vedic texts, is that a truthful account, or is that a novel? You know, somebody's
no, I
story.
Think, again, I don't think that ancient cultures simply created things out of whole cloth. I think they worked with what they saw and worked with what they believed they knew. Now, could they have been projecting on into their belief system these stories? Maybe. We come to see that the Greeks, you know, certainly did that with the mythology of the various gods and goddesses. Or maybe the gods and goddesses were in fact ancient aliens.
Well, so are you saying that, and I'm not sure I'm clear on this, are you saying that the ancient Hindus, the Vedic, the people at that time had this technology, or were they talking about technology that presumably from aliens?
I believe they're talking about technology presumably from aliens that they saw.
Yeah,
that's all documented, and those documents in the Vedic texts are 5,000, 6,000 years old, right, Bill? They're really old, and they're very detailed, and also they talk about battles and things that look
nuclear.
Similar to, nuclear, right, Doug? Yeah.
So a question from the chat room, if UFOs were more obvious in the 50s, why not so apparent today?
They are apparent today. I mean, look at the skies over New York. Look at the skies over Texas. Look at the Stephenville case. Look at the Needles, California case. Look at the UFOs over Mount Shasta. Look at the Gulf Breeze sightings. Of course they're apparent today. They are as apparent today as they were in the 1950s. It's just today we find ways to make fun of them. And we and cadres of debunkers tell us that what we're really looking at is something else.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know any more than we do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Bill, I remember watching a program. I think it was on the History Channel, too. And it was about UFOs. And they showed a convention from the 1950s. And they showed, you know, how they'd like to show these people that looked utterly ridiculous. And here was this gentleman who was saying to people, he said, I think he was wearing an Indian headdress, or maybe it might not have been him, but nonetheless, what he basically said was, and I'm guessing the vintage of the film was probably mid or early 1950s, that sooner or later, or in very close time frame, there would be disclosures about what was actually going on. And here it is, 50-some years later, and we still hear that we're on this verge of a paradigm shift that sooner or later is going to happen. And my question is based on your experience, do you think we're really ever going to have that paradigm shift?
I think disclosure, quad disclosure, has already happened. If it didn't happen in 1947 when the Army admitted to capturing a flying saucer, then it happened in 1952 on Movie Tone News. Then it happened over Phoenix in 1997 when the major network carried the Phoenix lights. Then it's been happening about RAF Bentwaters that took place in 1980 or Cosford in the 1990s or Belgium when this flying triangle outran F-16 jets, or Leslie Kane and James Fox's National Press Club conference in 2007, or Robert Hastings' press conference in 2010. The point is, it's happened again and again and again and again. It's not disclosure that people are asking for, and I think John Alexander in his new book on UFOs makes this very clear, that it's not disclosure people are asking for, it's confirmation of the disclosure that they're asking for.
Mm. Yes.
And those are two different things.
Yep. Interesting position.
Yeah. And so do you think that they're on some sort of campaign, long-range campaign, to, you know, desensitize? Or is it that they, you know, what would be the point, I guess, in keeping it from
the government?
Yeah.
What if in fact, I mean, you could speculate, if you're saying, do I know, the answer is no, but can I speculate?
Yeah, no, speculate. Yeah,
you can speculate a million ways.
Absolutely.
One way is if you put this into real human bureaucracy, government policy terms, I look at some of the events that are taking place now that presumably are events emanating from decades ago. For example, when one of the Mars climate landers tested the Martian soil, it was in 1976,
uh-huh.
and came up with positive results for the remains of a biological process in the Martian soil.
Yep.
Well, everybody said it was fraudulent, fake. Now, suddenly, they're saying, well, maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was real. Maybe there was life on Mars. Well, we know there was life on Mars because that remains of that Martian soil made it to Earth in Martian rock. So the point is, was there life on Mars? Pretty much, I think the answer is yes. So extraterrestrial life, yes, it existed. Okay, water on Mars, water on the moon, yes, is one of the clear ingredients for life. Water on the satellite Cassini or the moon Io.
Yeah, and Bill, when we were kids, because I think we're contemporaries, who would have thought while we're watching Walt Disney that we would be looking at life or oceans on the moons of those giants out there?
That's right. So as it stands now, we believe this stuff is real. There could be any form of life, of entities living out there in the solar system. And that's just planets and planetoids and moons in our own solar system. And that's just right. Now we're finding that there is arsenic-based life living here on planet Earth, not carbon-based life, arsenic-based life. And if you go back to the 1940s, 1947, 1948, and you talk about what Brittain and Shockley did when they were using silicon as a base for the transistor, and they couldn't get the transistor, what they were calling a transistor, it wasn't called a transistor then, but they couldn't get that device, that switch, to pass one electron through at a time on-off, and in a specific direction, right? In a light bulb, which is essentially an Edison tube, electrons go both ways. So they're creating a non-Edison tube, non-vacuum tube switch for electrons. Well, it wasn't until they discovered the fact that by doping the silicon base with arsenic, could they then control the electron flow. And I thought it was so fascinating that here we've discovered arsenic-based life. So for all the arguments on planet Earth that we're carbon units, to put it in Star Trekian terms, now suddenly there are arsenic units. If arsenic units exist here and are viable life forms in certain parts of one of the most inhospitable parts of our planet, imagine what could exist out there. So, I mean, church turns around and says, if life exists out there in the universe, well, obviously it was also created by the Creator. Well, you know, I mean, and you say, wow, that's fundamental. Holy mackerel, the church, whoa, that's it. You know, well, what is the church going to say? I mean, think about it. What could the church possibly say? Are they going to say, if life exists in the universe, the Creator didn't create it? That's stupid.
Taking a brilliant move.
Of the Old Testament, of course the Creator created it. I mean, but are we being prepared? I believe we're being prepared gradually. And I think that science fiction writers have laid this out decades ago. Frank Herbert did in Dune. Isaac Asimov did in Foundation. Gradually being prepared for the revelation that there is life out there, and the larger revelation that the life out there is here, and probably we're the life out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, we need to take our place amongst the... I mean, I'm not saying Star Trek-ish in Star Trek-ish manner, but we need to take our place and realize that we can't be so egocentric. We have to realize that we're part of this gigantic, immense universe. And, of course, when that does happen, then I think one of the things that they're probably so terribly afraid of is that then we're going to have to reevaluate our place in the universe, because for years and years, every institution we have, is telling us that we're the center of the universe.
Well, I mean, I'll take it even further. Make it even more fundamental. What if the life out there is us? I mean, that's more fundamental.
Yeah.
And what if the abilities that those life forms possess are the same abilities that we possess? I mean, the Army has already discovered that human beings have a sixth sense. There have been many, many dissertations written on the fact that the paranormal does exist. We're just calling it the paranormal, but it really is normal.
Yeah, for lack of a better term, right.
There was a study at Cornell showing that human inclination can actually affect future events. Think at how
stunning intention.
We create the future. Is that the law of attraction? Is that the secret? Well, if all that's true, how do you then govern a race that can create its future through its own volition? Are we really like the people on Forbidden Planet, the Krill?
The
monster that destroyed them? Is that what we're being kept from?
Yeah. And monsters from the id.
Right. And in fact, is the Krill science fiction, or is it something we already figured out in the 1950s?
Yeah. All right. Well, here's a statement, then we got to take some questions because we're heading up toward the hour here. I just wanted to make the statement that I think one of these days we're going to look back, and not necessarily us, but humans are going to look back and say, why, of course there's life out there. It's like looking at the ocean and wondering if there's fish in there, and we one day, oh, of course there's fish in there, duh. You know, it's like a no-brainer. I mean, it's prolific. I think that the universe is teeming with life on a variety of levels. So let's get some questions here out of the way, a couple anyway. One question is, have you looked into the Bosnian pyramids? If so, what do you make of them?
I have not looked into the Bosnian pyramids. They're coming up this year on Ancient Aliens.
Okay. Let's see. Here's another question, Mr. Burns. On your program, UFO Hunters, there was a case where a former black U.S. Marine, I think that was Terrell Copeland, perhaps?
Yep.
Had several encounters while stationed in the Hampton Roads area. Have you had any follow-up with him?
Yeah, I have. And Terrell Copeland is happily pursuing. I mean, remember, that was the fundamental issue in which I said, you know, was he an alien hybrid? And he said, yes, he believed he was, and Pat Oscar blew a gasket. The thing was that he's followed up with that. And we've stayed in contact over the years. And he said, in fact, he's pursuing whatever course of study he has to have, because he does believe that he is able to wield powers that are not recognized as human, although I believe they are human.
Has he demonstrated any of these?
Yeah, he's able to foresee the future. He's able to predict certain kinds of things. He's able to make certain kinds of things happen with his mind. And he's with a group of other people, by the way, who call themselves alien hybrids.
So he's basically demonstrating psychic abilities.
Yeah, which he demonstrated, by the way, when he was a child.
Right, which is common for those with natural, more advanced, highly natural psychic gifts. Wow, that was a mouthful. Okay, cool. So we are coming down on the last 5 or so minutes. We've talked about a number of fascinating things here: ancient aliens, ancient technology. Man, we could just go on. I'm happy to hear that Ancient Aliens, the show, is coming back. And
hey, if we could just switch gears for a second,
yeah,
Doug, maybe we could get Bill to tell us a little bit about his latest book.
That's exactly where I was
going
to go. Yeah.
I thought that's where you might be going, because I think it's pretty exciting about what Bill's working on. So go ahead.
Well, I mean, I've got a book out right now that folks can get on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or in the bookstores. It's called Aliens in America, and it's a travel guide for people who want to visit UFO hotspots. Easy book to read, easy book to follow. 20 great hotspots from Roswell to Phoenix to Hudson Valley to Pine Bush to Gulf Breeze, Pascagoula, Mississippi. It lays out the case, lays out the arguments pro and con for the case, tells you what attractions are there, like are there UFO conferences, celebrations, whatever, how to get there, where to stay, where to eat. So it's a great travel guide. A book that's coming out this month deviates from UFO phenomena, although in this coming issue in UFO magazine we're dealing with that phenomena. It is troubled individuals who claim they are victims of alien abduction. And what do you do with these troubled individuals? Their complaints can range all the way from basic neuroses, belief systems, I've been abducted by aliens, all the way to outright psychosis. And this book that's coming out this month is about psychosis. It's about the psychosis, the psychopathic behavior, specifically forms of schizophrenia, which break out in childhood and which can plague someone to the point where by the time the person is a young adult, i.e. Jared Loughner, Cho Sung Hui at Virginia Tech, where the person actually becomes violent listening to command voices inside his own head. And the book is called Suicidal Mass Murderers, a criminological study, because it's for criminology classes, of why they kill. And so it's a book that we've been working on for years, ever since the 2007 murders. And the point of the book is to come up with ways to define the kinds of mental illness that that really is the foundation for this kind of behavior, whether it's Cho Sung Hui at Virginia Tech, Gerard Loughner at Tucson, this person George Sardini in Pittsburgh, the Red Lake murders, Klebold and Harris at Columbine, and on and on and on. Why do these people explode in this kind of apocalyptic rage to the point where they kill others, then take their own lives? What's going on? Are they just pure criminals? Are they spoiled children? Or is there some deep-seated psychosis that can be identified, isolated, treated, so the crime can be prevented?
It sounds like there's going to be some fascinating psychodynamics.
Yes. And then at the end of the book, it's why we look the other way. Why institutions? Cho Sung Hui, who killed 32 people besides himself at Virginia Tech, was involuntarily committed months before the murders, and he was released on his own recognizance. They didn't even bother to call, he was a college student. They didn't even bother to call his parents to say that he was making threatening gestures with a knife towards a student. He threatened her and threatened suicide. They didn't even call his parents.
Wow, fascinating stuff.
Yeah, well, we wish you the best of success on that. And that was a great bridge, because what you were saying about, you know, abductions and so forth, and the schizophrenia, it can be a real issue with those. And speaking of alien abductions, next week, next Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern, please join us again. We'll have Phil Hoyle on. He'll be talking about alien abductions and animal mutilations. So we'll have him here then. Also like to invite those of you who have not visited Paranexus.org to come and visit us. We'd love to have you as members. Paranexus is a professional anomalous researcher association. We are made up of all kinds of people in all kinds of different anomalous disciplines, whether it's parapsychology, ufology, psychic development, psi research, and on and on. We'd love to have you visit. We appreciate everybody who has tuned in to our live broadcast tonight on our new night and the return of Paranexus Universe. Appreciate those in the chat room with the questions and the activity, as well as those who called in. And Bill, thanks so much for joining us tonight. It's been a pleasure having you on the program.
It was my pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Yeah.
A pleasure and an honor to have you, and we'd like to have you back sometime if you come visit with us.
Again?
Really enjoyed your video. Absolutely.
My pleasure.
Really enjoyed having you tonight,
yeah.
Bill.
We wish you the best of success on everything, too.
Thank you.
Keep on. We look forward to seeing you on Ancient Aliens. All right, folks, that's a wrap for another show. You know, Grant, it's been 3 years we've been doing this now, and we're approaching our 150th show. And
wow.
It's just we've had over 115,000 listens, and we're out of time. Thanks, everybody.
Well, it's great to be back, folks. We're looking forward to seeing you every week.
Good night.
Good night.